Hello and welcome back to the Research VR podcast, everyone. The podcast about the science and the design behind virtual reality. That's a new title I threw into our subtitle today because we talk about design a lot. I am your host, Oz Balabanian, and with me today is our special guest, editor at Upload VR, Ian Hamilton.
Hello, everyone.
Hi, Ian. And our co-host, Mr. Peter Lekhoff.
Hello.
All right, guys, this is a episode I've been waiting to do for a while. Ian, I've known Ian for quite some time, and most of our listeners here probably know him through a lot of the articles that they've read from Ian over the past like 3 or 4 years even. I think you're probably the first VR reporter that I started reading from way back in like 2013.
I was there early. I got to cover the founding of Oculus back to the Kickstarter when I was at the Orange County Register. So I have a little bit longer, right, you know, history than most people following them.
You also have a photo where you're actually wearing the prototype of a cardboard version of the Oculus, right?
Brendan Arib gave me the duct tape demo. I think it was late 2012, and Palmer was over there with disassembled stuff all over his desk, and I'm like, I want to go talk to Palmer, and they didn't really want me to talk to Palmer at the time.
They're like, put the nerds away. Don't let them talk to the nerds. We'll just keep the CEO and the spokespersons in the front. little did we know, those names will be also relevant for the next years ahead. I guess, yeah, before we dive into the main topic, which we'll be talking and discussing a lot about the CNN article that Professor Jeremy Bailenson put out in terms of guns and using VR for training and mass shooters and that whole can of worms that you can imagine. It's a big topic in the U.S. And I think, as Peter was telling me before we started recording, it was a topic as well in Germany at some point recently. But before we go into all of those, I think talking a little bit about the history, I think, would be really fascinating. I think you've been in it longer than most people. What led you to cover the Kickstarter at first?
Well, yeah, I'd heard about it coming out of E3, and so I'd heard a lot of buzz. And basically, I knew Palmer Luckey was from Long Beach, and that was right outside of our coverage area. It was right at the edge of where we would cover things. So this is Orange County.
What were you writing for?
It's the Orange County Register, based in Santa Ana or Irvine, California. And I was a technology reporter for the organization. And I had heard about the Kickstarter and was obviously pretty interested and excited about it. But I saw that it was just kind of at the edge of the coverage area. So Long Beach is in Los Angeles County. Orange County is right across the border. And then I heard a couple things, that they were getting office space in Orange County. And then I heard Brendan was coming on as CEO. And Brendan was from Gaikai, which was another Orange County startup that got purchased by Sony to do their PlayStation Now streaming. So he was leaving one Orange County company and basically setting up office space with another Orange County company. So I got a really good excuse to go out there. Yeah, I had a good excuse to go out there. And I remember going out there and doing a couple stories. I did a very good story that first time. And I called two people after my initial demo and an interview. I called Jeremy Bailenson at Stanford. Wow. And I called Mark Bolus at USC. And I wanted to know, okay, is this legit? Are they actually going to produce good VR? Is it good enough and consumer ready? And then, so I called Bailenson, and I remember him breaking down the basics of VR at the time. He basically said, VR is three things: tracking, rendering, and display. And right now we have that in our homes with things like the PrimeSense Kinect, and that basically tracks, and then the display render, or the machine renders, and then the TV displays. And so we've got these pieces for virtual reality in our homes right now. We just need to make it everything you see, and that's essentially VR. He broke it down so well for me in that story. And then Bolus basically explained to me, it seems like they've got a really good recipe, because he had just uh, He had done the FOV to Go project, which was the cardboard based system. Funny story, side note, I had actually gotten a call the summer before from USC's PR representative saying there's a local VR headset at a local conference and you should come out and see it. And it's basically just putting your phone in a cardboard headset. And I remember telling the PR person at the time, no, I'm too busy. I can't go see that. But if I had gone to go see that person and that headset, it would have seen Palmer Luckey a year before everyone else. And I said no.
Oh, interesting. So that was Palmer's project at USC?
He was working on it, I believe. I don't remember how much of it was his.
Right. Wow, that's a fascinating history, actually. I didn't realize there was the phone-based cardboard, you know, prototypes even before Google was pushing that.
Oh, yeah.
In fact, it's actually very funny. One of the first devices was Durovis Dive that was surprisingly, I think, 100 kilometers away from where I'm living right now in Germany, founded by some marketing agency, and they created this open source hardware. And then later, the guy who did the project at this agency, I don't remember the name right now, actually went to Google, and I think this is how the cardboard project got kickstarted. So I actually bought the Durovis Dive before the cardboard existed and showed it to my professor. That's how we convinced him to do VR science.
That's really cool. And Ian, I mean, in terms of knowing Balance was VR something that you were really interested in from like a research perspective, or like why were you even following up on this?
I had been vaguely aware of like it wasn't ViewMaster, but I can't remember the company that built an early phone-based VR headset. There was some toy that was like years ahead of everything else.
Year are you kind of thinking about?
I'm thinking it. I think I found an app on the App Store that was from that period, but it was maybe 2011 or before. I want to say there was an early toy, and so it didn't seem the concept of using your phone for VR at the time didn't kind of blow me away. It was something you could do, but it wasn't very good quality. And then you had these Oculus folks coming along and showing how they were going to do something that was PC powered, but using the economics of a phone system and using that to kind of mainstream VR. You could see the pieces, like they weren't saying phone VR is good enough. They were saying phone VR is a starting point. We're going to do something much better than that. And you could see how if they just improved tracking a little bit, rendering a little bit and display a little bit, they would have something pretty compelling. And so I kind of got hooked and I kept coming back to my editors with more stories. Like I wanted to do what's Palmer's background story. I wanted to do all these different stories. And I remember the editors hadn't had the demos. I couldn't get them to go over, you know, take the time out of their day to go over to Oculus headquarters and put the headset on. I finally got one of my editors to do it, and it was a little bit easier to get my stories done after that about VR. But I remember one of the editors kind of telling me, or telling my other editor, kind of lay off the VR stories for now. I remember getting a call while I was driving from the editor that saw VR and said, "Have you heard the latest? They just got acquired by Facebook." And I remember I had that feeling in my stomach that a lot of people, I think, that day did. So I don't know. It's kind of like this. It's this moment of realization. It's going to happen. And Facebook is going to be the company to do it. And I, like many people, had sort of that big brother fear in my heart. And I wanted to make sure that the future was safe. And I think the moment that happened, you knew, number one, VR was going to happen on a massive scale. But number two, we need to be careful.
Yeah, those are strong kind of themes that have stayed relevant throughout that time, right? It's like, it's going to happen, but let's proceed with caution and keep an eye out on the, you know, potential dangers that can arise from it. But I mean, obviously, like, really enamored by like the technology itself and what it can enable.
It's awesome. It's scary. I mean, even from that time, I remember I read Balanson's book over the next 2 years. that he did with Jim Blaskovich. I think Infinite Reality.
Infinite Realities, right?
Yeah, I think the other guy was at Santa Barbara. I think he's at Santa Barbara College.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And what's maybe last question for me before we go to the news? How do you see, with a lot of insights you have right now, and also you know your history of covering everything, where the wave of VR or XR, however you call it, right? Well, where are we heading right now? Because different companies like Facebook is now putting a lot of pressure on the mobile, and they want to have mobile devices. Vive releases a more desktop, powerful device, whatever. Where do you see this whole movement going?
Yeah, there's a lot to answer there. Standalone has been the thing on the future roadmaps since the beginning, and I don't think anyone outside of Facebook or HTC or Microsoft have experienced what it's like to invite a standalone system into your home. I remember asking Facebook at Oculus Connect 4, would you call Oculus Go a communications device? And they weren't answering anything at the time. The only thing that they would say at the time was that Oculus Go would be compatible with all the Gear VR content. And if it is compatible with all the Gear VR content, you can assume that there's a microphone on board, because some apps use the microphone for certain things. And I think what happens is you've got a headset sitting there that can ring with a VR call. And I'm hoping that feature is there. I think it needs to be there in order for it to be a successful device. But when my VR headset is sitting on the table and it rings and I put the headset on and I'm talking to you, that's a transformative moment in technology. And I don't think anyone has experienced it broadly yet.
I think you tweeted about this in terms of like that this existed in a form with Altspace when they had calling for the Gear VR, right?
Yeah, and you can stick your phone into the headset and then hope that the app launches because you press the link right before you clicked the phone into the headset. It was clunky, really, really clunky to do that whole process to get into VR. And even putting your Rift on. I mean, I was 5 minutes late to our recording session because I needed to go run and get my Oculus Touch hand controllers. It's one extra thing to get you into VR, and then the two sensors and you know the whole thing. It's just every single time you want to meet up with someone, there's a giant process involved, and that process can be anywhere from 3 minutes to an hour and a half of troubleshooting, and you don't want to meet in VR after you've been troubleshooting for an hour and a half,
right?
But the payoff of meeting in VR is huge. I mean, the more we meet in big screens, the more I realize I also started to sometimes meet people that I met from around the world and we can't see each other because they're far and away. Actually, you know, try to meet with them in VR because it kind of adds a certain personal touch to it. It's a wonderful thing. If the hustle wouldn't be that big, like the payoff is huge. Like the next step after phone, like the virtual presence. But
I can't wait for the VR call. Like you, when you call me on my headset and it's ready to go instantly, I will pick up that call 9 times out of 10 probably. I suppose it would be nice to know who's calling me before I put the headset on. I don't know how they're gonna solve that.
It's a surprise.
It's like it's going back to original telephones, right? You're like, I don't know who the hell this is. Let's pick it up. It could be the president. It could be my ex-girlfriend, you know?
Actually, yeah. I mean, the old phones didn't have a screen. And people still loved it, so it's fine.
Yeah, I mean, it was a crapshoot. It's like, I don't know. It could be the most important phone call of my life, or it could be the freaking worst. Similarly, so I guess that actually, I want to expand on two things that you were talking about. One is all-in-one headsets that I think now, just as of like for over the next 6 to 12 months, I think are going to become a real thing. You're probably one of the only people I know that have tried the most iterations from it. And I guess the other topic that we just touched on is calling in VR. And I just had a really interesting experience with a form of that, with a fully volumetric video of a person being live streamed into my headset and in real time, like talking to them.
When?
Yeah. this was like 2 or 3 days ago. This company called EF, I think, EF Eve, but they're, I forget what company is called, what EF stands for, but I'll have everything linked in the description. But so they are basically a volumetric video platform, and they're using Kinect and Intel's RealSense sensors to, you know, essentially create a 3D version of a person only by using two sensors. So the call I had was them using two Kinect without a green screen in just a normal lit house without any special lighting on the person. Yeah. I saw that they were just had like lamps in the room, and we were talking on Google Hangouts at first, and they were just like, "Oh, do you have our app?" And I was like, "Sure." They're like, "Okay, put it on. Like, we're going to call you with that." And so, okay, like I put it on, and then suddenly I get a Skype call, like a Skype looking message, and I accept it. And boom, right in front of me pops in the woman I was just talking to. And I still had the Google Hangouts call open. So I was kind of like checking the latency, and it was like maybe a second or two off, but it was mind blowing. I was like able to like look around her, rotate her, make her big or small. And like, I don't have the setup on my house, but it gave me a taste of like, this can definitely be a thing over the next however many years. And it feels cool. Like it feels like this is, I don't know exactly what situations it will be better than phone calls or texts, but you know, there are situations that it makes sense. And I think that's what we'll, once there's more users and you know, better integrations into these systems, we'll figure out those use cases. But I mean, it's not a new thing, or so I've discovered. People on Reddit have been like, "Oh, the professor in UC Davis has done this, you know, 5 years ago." I mean, that's true. It's not the first that I had seen, but like it was the first time I tried it on a consumer device, on a consumer app in my house that I didn't even know I had. So that was new to me. Well, and so I guess, do you have any thoughts in terms of like, you know, your communication seems to be a big aspect that you're really interested in, Ian. Where are we now, and where do we see this going?
So I was thinking about while you're talking about that, Bailenson's book, his second book that just came out, Experience on Demand. He basically flat out says pretty bluntly in the book that he doesn't think until we can reproduce all of the intricacies of face-to-face interaction that VR will take off on. Maybe it's reversed. Maybe he says that the killer app for VR is capturing all of the intricacies of interpersonal communication. And there's an experiment that I believe he describes at one point, talking about how in a small like setting of a couple people in a, like a circle, they charted out all the little ticks and body movements that people have with each other, and it's basically described like a invisible ballet of all of these little things that you do to tip off the people around you that you're either ready to listen or you're ready to talk, or the other people are going to talk and you're trying to express that you're into them and what they're saying. Yes. You know, it's incredible how much of that is lost even here. Like right in here, we've got a little bit of our shoulder movement. If you bob your head up a little bit, right, you've got your head movement. We're in big screen right now talking. I can't remember if we said that. But yeah, we can see you can get the, like, I'm using my hands to gesture that I've still got more to say. And there's a million more examples of that in face-to-face communication. And Bailenson's book points out that once we're able to do that and it feels completely normal, that's when VR takes off on a scale. And I don't know how many more sensors we need for that really to take off. I don't know how far off that is.
Do you think one iteration of that becoming a thing will be less of like actually putting sensors around your room to capture yourself in a volumetric sense, and more of the sensors that will be integrated into our headsets, the eye trackers, the face trackers, the mouth trackers, right? Like, that's the direction.
Well, so UI changes so dramatically when you add eye trackers. And I think we need to have that one first. So yes. Number one, being able to know whether my face is looking at an odd angle directly between the both of you. And if my eyes were tracked right, you'd know which of you I was addressing at any given moment. And then, but just I don't think devs, I've tried to capture it in GIFs form.
Sure.
I say GIFs. But I tried to be polite for you guys. But yeah, I tried to capture it in every form I can, but I don't think you can really grasp how dramatically eye tracking changes your user interface until you've locked onto something with your eyes and thrown it with your hand and can really feel that targeting work so seamlessly. Yes. So I think we'll have eye trackers,
right? Like, yeah, totally superpowers. Great. Is that how you felt? Actually,
yep.
Have you tried this Toby experience? So,
yep, Toby was the last one I tried.
Yeah. Because what you described is just the same thing I tried on the VRST, where Toby had a boost and you would basically lock with your eyes things and just throw it. It's magic. It's great.
So, yeah, that was, I think, their demo that they first started showing last year. The most recent demo that I saw at CES had sliders and UI items that you could adjust just by looking at the sliders. And like there was an Star Trek Bridge Crew type interface in front of me. So it's this big panel with a whole bunch of sliders on it. And all I had to do was look at the slider and then like click my finger or slide my finger on a touchpad. Like I didn't have to reach forward and interact with any of these things on this panel in front of me. It was just eye lock, move my hand and or move my finger.
That's fascinating. God, that actually translates so well to just already existing desktop apps that are already like right now are too hard to control in VR. I mean, using big screen or the VR version of a similar app, but like hearing that makes me so hopeful for in terms of like the precise and accurate motions that we have with mouse and keyboards currently with the apps that exist. I think will not only be matched in VR, but superseded, right?
I'm really curious, once you get used to that interface, how much faster you get. But just from the initial 5-minute demo, they were flipping the eye tracking on and off, and the headset feels broken after they turn it off.
Yeah.
That's how dramatic your brain switches over, and like, I want that.
Fascinating.
Yeah,
God, that makes sense. That's going to... It's not only, I mean, the argument for having eye trackers in VR is like, I think, threefold. Like, one is UI and superpowers. Second is social VR and eyes and cues. And third is just foveated rendering. And all three of those together, it's like, it's a no-brainer that it'll be a thing.
Exactly.
If not in this all-in-one headsets that are coming out, but the step right after that, the PC VR and the second gen all-in-ones, right? Like, it has to be a thing. So,
absolutely. Like, each point of those is like something that I would totally pay for. Like, foveated rendering gives a better picture, you know, more smooth UI. I would totally get it. Social interaction. I mean, I prefer VR for social interaction in terms of like, this is my most fun thing to do in VR. Hanging around with a big screen, meeting people, multi-screen. So every of those features is giving so much value, and I just don't understand why it's still not in every headset. Because it's very cheap technology, and even from the perspective of science, I mean, what you have been basically describing, Ian, is what apes and wolves do even before they evolved into humans. So they communicate a lot with gestures and where they look to. If you observe two wolves, working on a project, for example, like pulling together a rope to get something, there are nice experiments. They don't make sounds, but they communicate somehow. And they make sure that they understand each other, that they both need to pull on that rope. And humans do the same too. I mean, where are you looking? What's your gaze? How is your face changing? All this nonverbal communication is very crucial. That's why people who have certain diseases, hunters obviously too, but people who have certain diseases
hunters cannot talk.
Yes, that's true. You need to. Even like special ops, right? They do all those weird signs like left, right, fire in the hole, whatever. Like those weird signs with the fingers. That's also sign language. Sign language. You can actually communicate fully without speaking. You can just use signs. Like this is the ability that we have and so powerful.
That's a cool game that someone should make in VR once the eye trackers are integrated. It's like cut off the mic and just like have the teams have to interact, you know, either gesture based or eye based, or you know, get the idea across. That could be a really fun game.
Yes.
Okay, so I want to be cognizant of our time here for Ian. The thing I want to talk a little bit about, we can take some more time on this, but are the all-in-one headsets. And if we can kind of go through the landscape of what is going to be available, or what you've tried and what's going to be available. And actually, what I'm most interested in is what ecosystem, what app stores are they going to have access to? Like, what is the Oculus Santa Cruz going to be in terms of content? Like, is it a Go Plus, or is it a Rift Minus or Rift equivalent?
Well, so that's why it's so fun to start off with that basis of Balance and breaking down tracking, rendering, and display, right? Those are going to be the three things that you're going to find different between the different headsets. And obviously, stores are going to be different, too, at the end of the day, because that's the platforms trying to make money off of this whole ecosystem. But so you've got Google's tracking, Microsoft's tracking, and then Oculus's tracking system. And you've also got the chip company, Qualcomm, providing its own technology that more or less seems to be across the board used in the mobile systems. I found it interesting that you go back to last year and Intel closed up a lot of their VR headset efforts because Microsoft's tracking tech was so good. It just locked out anyone from needing Intel's tracking technology, at least for VR headsets. So right now, if you look at the standalones, the difference is in whether they're in a developer state or even pre-developer state, or whether they're consumer ready. The consumer ready things that you're seeing have three DOF controllers, more or less. You've got, I haven't tried the Pico, but it sounds like the controllers, from what I've heard, the controllers aren't there yet. Santa Cruz, with the controllers that I tried last year at OC4, I don't remember it bugging out. It might have tracked once or twice, like maybe jumped a little bit. If I recall correctly, I think I tried the test where you look away and then look back and to see if your hand drifts. I think if I did that to an extreme, I would see the drift happen a little bit, but it would snap back into place very quickly. The most impressive thing about the Santa Cruz tracking was when I reached behind myself to here and grabbed something and brought it forward. So I'm looking straight ahead, and I grabbed something here, and I pulled it forward. And it
back
was maybe
here being like your wallet or something, or like a gun behind you.
It was something attached to the wall. It was like an object I needed to grab off the wall and throw at the enemy. And the cameras could see it. That was the impressive thing. So I was here, and it could see to about right here with me looking forward.
You're right, and now moving this is, actually something.
I'm moving something. But yeah, it was, I don't know, 45 degrees behind me and maybe 2 feet, and it was still able to pick up that hand movement.
Are you sure it didn't use IMUs?
Well, I think it used some combo of internal tracking with maybe picking it up from here. Maybe it did some trickery and knew that there was an object back here and assumed because I did the grip motion that I grabbed it. The bottom line is it worked and it felt like that extra bit that I need to really feel like my hands are really here. There's so many motions like pulling a bow and arrow back that I don't know if any sensors that are ready today in 2018 are going to pick up. But that's a motion I'm going to want to do quite a bit. I think they can solve that. And I think bottom line is, as of all the things I've seen, I think Facebook is furthest along with both inside out tracking and really, really immersive hand controllers in a very comfortable headset that renders at a good frame rate. I tried to get that info out of Carmack back at OC4, like what display are you using? And he said, we're not using a Rift display. That's all he would say. But it looked great.
Did you notice it looking better than a Rift?
It's so hard the different elements that play there between frame rate and lenses changing the distortion, or the like the god rays and stuff. I did notice god rays. I notice less of a screen door effect than I'm seeing right now in big screen. But I hate saying that it's the end-all be-all of displays. The Pro is the Vive Pro has an amazing display, and that looks great. But it just overall, I felt like the all-in-one package that Facebook was working on was the best I'd seen yet. The only caveat to that is we haven't seen what's behind closed doors at Microsoft, and we haven't seen what's behind closed doors at Google and Apple.
So Google. Yeah. So I guess let's paint the landscape a little bit again. You mentioned Oculus. They have their all-in-one. Santa Cruz is what they're calling it for now. Google, with their Daydream platform, I think have announced the Lenovo all-in-one headset.
Mirage.
And then Vive, on the other end, has the Vive Focus, which for now is only launched in China. Have you had a chance to try that yet?
Yeah, I've tried. I kind of have the same feeling about all of the headsets, including Vive Focus, that have a 3DOF controller. They may be good for watching movies on airplanes or trains, but I have a hard time seeing a massive user base beyond that. The 3DOF controller is absolutely maddening when you want to reach forward and grab something and you have to lean forward and grab it, because it's only going to keep a consistent distance for your hand from the headset. So you've physically got to retrain your body to lean forward in order to grab things that have depth. They're all trying, different devs are trying various simulation systems, like you can slide your finger on the pad to simulate a little bit of depth, but it's not natural, it doesn't feel right.
No, and I think once you actually, you know, spend decent time in a Vive or an Oculus, you just don't want to go back. It just feels strange. It just feels like using a way too old computer, or why is the laptop so clumsy and doesn't respond fast? I actually used to something else. You just don't want to accept it. Like you described with eye tracking, the moment they turned it off, you felt like, I want it back. Why is it shitty right now?
Yep.
Yeah, that seems like a funny regression that we're like kind of back and forth with certain advancements and back again with, like, you know, Oculus Go isn't even out yet. And that's like almost a step backward in terms of like, oh, that's not even sixed off. That's freaking going back to gear.
That's a great point. And that's a lot of the commentary that you hear among people that really watch this industry closely is I got complaints saying you didn't include the chipset in your comparison, talking about all the different standalones. And the Oculus Go has an older chipset, and you should have mentioned that. And, I get that from, like, there's a certain subset of people that want the latest, absolute latest chips in their systems. But what matters is the end experience. And if Oculus Go runs at the solid frame rate the whole time, and it's a better experience than a Gear VR with all the Gear VR games that you've already they've already built, like, that's... that's a compelling $200 package.
And it's I think what a lot of people miss is the fact that it's not just about you know, the specs of the device, which I usually also find very interesting, but also the abstraction. Like when you run the Gear VR, you have basically an Android system that runs in the background, and on top of that, you run the Gear VR software. Now, when you take away the whole Android system, you obviously have more performance for just the Gear VR apps, so you kind of have more performance even when you would potentially have a weaker chip. So it's like with cameras those days, you know, software determines the quality of a picture way more than just a sensor in a smartphone, and it's also the optimization. Why is Apple's iPhone running slightly longer on a battery than an average Android? Well, they basically optimized the hell out of the PCB and also on the system of a chip. So it's not just the gigahertz, which actually don't mean anything, it's also the way they do the optimization. Even when you have the chipset, even when you license an ARM, like what is ARM? You just get basically the description of the processor, but you can change it yourself. You can print it yourself in different factories. So it's very hard without user testing or actually trying it out yourself to say what is better, what is not, just on the specs. Because a lot of Chinese companies do great VR headsets on paper. But when you try them out, well, some are good, some are less good, even though the specs look very, you know, fantastic. So,
yep. You nailed so much of it. One thing I wanted to say, what about the switch to standalone is just recently we had the Rift go offline for a full day because of the security certificate thing. We also have you just talked about it with Gear VR and having to deal with all of those existing operating system thing. Another example of that problem is the way that Gear VR uses Chromecast. It's not good. It's
buggy.
In many apps, audio doesn't come across.
Yeah.
And I don't know if they've updated in the last 3 or 4 months. Maybe they have. Maybe it's better. But on Daydream, it's beautiful. On the Chromecast integration is amazing. I don't notice any streaming lag up on the TV. It's full screen. The viewpoint is really well rendered for what the person in VR is seeing, and I'm able to have fun with my family because that is the way it works. But that's Google controlling its entire operating system, its whole ecosystem. And you see Facebook again and again and again coming up against these limits of operating in someone else's sandbox. And that's the biggest switchover that happens when Facebook controls the whole ecosystem. Suddenly, does Facebook want to sell its own version of Chromecast? Because that makes VR way, 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 way better. I don't know. There's all these things that happen.
I can't imagine them trying to sell a dongle just for
a
headset, right? Unless it comes included or something.
Exactly. But
they're not going to try and compete against both Apple TV and Chromecast and Amazon Fire Stick or whatever. What other content would they want to sell on that? Like Facebook's Watch tab?
Well,
they just paid yesterday for MLB games. They're going to be exclusively broadcasting some MLB games. I mean, they're not going to do it overnight. They're not going to do it overnight, but it will. It's their direction, right? It's the direction the whole company is going. Once you have one successful product, then you can have all these these secondary products that enhance this product, also stand on their own. Mm. You know, when they went out and tried to do a phone, there was only so much they could do operating the way they were. Right. Here, once you have one solid product, you can build all these other things that help it. It may take years.
Yeah, that's fascinating. All right, I think let's put this one to bed. I would love to come back to this and maybe make predictions in terms of like if you see these all-in-one headsets making a splash in the pool of VR. But okay, let's move on to another story that was unexpected this week. Magic Leap has now raised $500 million from where exactly, Ian?
Dubai?
Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia's investment arm.
And is that the government, I guess, has an investment branch?
You know, they do apparently have the press release from Magic Leap specifically says it's sovereign investment arm of Saudi Arabia. But obviously, that's a pretty politically charged investment to take. I believe it was someone like Uber did that before. Went over there and got a massive injection. It's still who you have on your board controls what kind of company you are. So curious who's on Magic Leap's board. I always wonder whenever I hear things about Magic Leap, who of the celebrities that talk about how amazing it is, which investment round did they participate and what organization did they participate on behalf of? Because if you've got a $50 million investment from some hedge fund, which celebrities and famous people that are talking about how amazing this technology is actually participated just secretly or quietly via some other investment entity. It's a massive amount of money. And the parallel I always draw with Magic Leap is to a company called, and you know this, Oz, I've talked to you about this before, I think, because you're a car guy. I can't think of its name.
Faraday Future?
No, Karma. Fisker.
Karma. Fisker Automotive. Fisker.
Yeah. So Fisker Automotive, what they did was they shipped their first car. It was a gasoline electric hybrid. You could run it on the battery alone, and then when you needed to go further, use the generator to charge up the battery to get you go a little bit more. So you could go from Vegas and get that extra range that people couldn't by adding that little gas generator. The first car cost like $120,000. Beautiful car, stood out on, anytime you ever looked at it, it was people would get whistles on the highway constantly, right, because it just, when it drove by you, you knew that was a Karma. It was that beautiful a car. Problem is, they couldn't get out all the bugs. They shipped it. The moment it shipped, it like broke on Consumer Reports. It was just this list of horrible things that happened. And one of the worst ones was Consumer Reports brought one. It broke before they even got it on the testing track. Fisker had to come and pick it up in a trailer and figure out what happened. Their batteries were faulty. They had one supplier for batteries. They had some kind of a contractual agreement with their supplier that said that you're responsible if the batteries go dead. Well, the supplier said, yeah, we're responsible. And then they went out of business within 6 months because they couldn't afford to cover all those costs. And so it was like a domino effect that their suppliers were dead. The thing is, though, the thing that I remember from that time was every 6 months, here's another $500 million. And they kept, you know, putting money into the coffers. And what I think started happening at the end was they had the second car. That their strategy was the same as Tesla. They build this expensive thing first, bring down the cost, and do a higher volume second unit. And they just could never make enough investment money to bridge that gap between car number one and car number two. The car number one ended up costing billions more to fix all those problems than they expected, and they never got to car two. And I always think of this when we talk about Magic Leap. They could ship an amazing, cool product that shows you all the depth of focus and reacts right. But if it's still bulky, if it's still $3,000, how many more billions are they going to need to engineer the second version that actually can make a mass market? They're not going to make enough money from the sale of the first unit to fund the second unit, because just the number of units that they're going to sell probably aren't going to be that high. So when you're investing in Magic Leap, are you aware how many more billions are going to be needed to get to unit two and unit three? Or are you being told that unit two is already in development and it's already really far along? Like that's where things start getting really ugly, and you might start seeing investor lawsuits when people that are, I remember one thing that happened to Fisker was, I think someone sued him saying they got a demand from Fisker saying you need to invest more, you're going to be diluted out of the company. I don't know whose beeping that is.
Is it me?
Sounds like it's coming from, not from my end, but I heard it coming from my right. Well, it's stopped now, so I think we're okay.
I just don't know if Fisker has, or that Magic Leap has enough money to get to Unit 2. Maybe they can ship Unit 1, but doesn't look like a consumer-ready unit to me, and I don't know that they're going to make enough to make that gap.
Well, I mean, even by the titling of the headset is like creators headset, guys, not consumer. Let's put this to the enthusiast market.
I have also another concern about Magic Leap, actually, is that they are trying to do a lot themselves. They are, you know, basically getting a lot of investment. And whenever a company, you know, tries to do hardware, software, platform, content, and everything else, I'm just always very suspicious, because I've seen a lot of companies that I supported on Kickstarter and also, you know, from news, just failing at one issue of this.
Like, Peter, building a hardware is Peter has difficult. A great track record on Kickstarter, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's like, I have a great track record. I actually just got a snoring mask. It works after 2 months from Shenzhen. It's crazy. But, when you look at Meta, right? So we just got the Meta 2 in the office. I play around with it. I mean, they also try to do too much for them, right? Like, the hardware itself is not so much ahead of everyone else. It's great, I like it, but they seem like try to bite too much from the cake. And when I look at Magic Leap, I have a feeling they're trying to swallow the
cake. You nailed it, and that adds cost, right? That's the difference in the analogy that to Fisker was. Fisker got destroyed because their suppliers couldn't keep supplying them during this tough time. So magically, maybe that's a benefit to their model, is if anything ever goes wrong, they can license out the technology if they need to, and still hopefully make make money that way. I still don't know. There's that gap between reality and what they've actually got ready in their labs and what they're telling their investors is where they are. If that gap gets too large, there's going to be ugliness.
Hey, man, if Shaq is telling me this is amazing, I believe him, okay? Shaq is my number one tech news source, and if he endorses it, I'm in. And also Beyonce, but I think she said it wasn't that great. So, I don't know. moving on. Let's see here. So, actually, the great point on the Fisker Camera, that was it was a beautiful car when it came out. I remember seeing it next to a Tesla dealership. And then, actually, no, their dealership was their dealership until they kind of ran out of business. And then Tesla took over it and then made it a Tesla dealership in Palo Alto. So, that was a very telling of the times in terms of like these early electric gas hybrids. And also the equivalent gas mileage that you got out of that car was around like 13 or 14 gallons or something per mile, or 13 miles per gallon. And so, yeah, it just didn't work on so many levels. And and here we are. But it was a beautiful car. It was the Henrik Fisker is the guy that designed the BMW Z8, which was one of the James Bond convertible BMWs that James Bond drove. So it's a beautiful car back in the day, and it still is. But anyway, moving on, we have, yes. I have a couple more questions. Let's quickly touch your New York trip, where I think you went to see The Void, and you also mentioned a Dreamscape in an immersive, which was a Steven Spielberg-backed location-based VR. And then we'll get to the guns discussion and hopefully well, not go over time, but yes.
It's a good transition because so I saw Dreamscape Immersive down in Los Angeles. That's the Steven Spielberg-backed startup that is doing something very similar to The Void. So they've got a location-based setup. They've got some environmental effects like mist and wind and vibrating Ooh. Floors to convince you that you're in a space. They've also got full body tracking. So Dreamscape made, they partnered with, I think it's a Swiss company or research lab. They have like the exclusive rights to this particular brand of body tracking. In sort of location-based setups. And so these little things clip around your feet. Another set, I think, clip around your wrists or your hands. And they're able to get a full body model out of just those extra points of data. And we had five or six people in the same space. And the thing that stuck with me about Dreamscape Immersive was their experience was called Alien Zoo, completely original IP. I was told afterwards that they had thought about making a movie about this Alien Zoo at one point, and they decided it was actually a good idea for VR. And what it is it's like Jurassic Park, but with aliens, and you go into this, you go out on this rotating, hovering platform, and the five or six of you all go out on this hovering platform together, and you go out into this zoo and see all these weird alien creatures. And they've even got great music from some company that's associated with Hans Zimmer. And when you go out into the zoo, there's this moment that feels exactly like the moment when they first see the dinosaurs in Jurassic Park. And it's wonderful, and it fills you with this wonder and exploration feeling. And it was an IP, so it was an original IP, so I wasn't comparing Alien Zoo in my mind to what it's like to play the video game of Alien Zoo, because I've never played the Alien Zoo video game and I've never seen the movie. This is the comparison to The Void, where The Void has done Ghostbusters and Star Wars. And when you come out of those experiences, you do the mental math in your head saying, going to see Star Wars in the theater costs me $20 and I get 2 hours of entertainment. I just spent $30 in there and I got 15 minutes of entertainment. It was cool. I felt like, you know, I was there, but I'm doing that mental comparison in my head. I'm also comparing Star Wars to Star Wars Battlefront. I'm comparing The Void to the Battlefront game, which is $60. And I'm again doing that math in my head saying, that's not right. I should just play the game. Why should I do this again? I didn't make that mental comparison in Alien Zoo because I didn't have those other things to do it. I was just left leaving there going, I visited an alien zoo. Oh, how much does it cost to go to the actual zoo? And then the math starts making a lot more sense because that mental comparison isn't being made. And then in New York, I got to see Neurogaming. And so that's a partnership between Wargaming, which is the company behind World of Tanks VR. They're Russia. They're Russia-based or have some history in Russia. And Neurogaming had an arcade very similar to IMAX. So IMAX has this big trestle metal structure, and they store the computers directly above the player on this metal structure. And then they have wires coming down from that, and that's how you get into VR, is the wire coming down is to your headset. And you've got full range to move around the room. You're not going to run into any equipment. Neurogaming has a very similar equipment setup for their arcades, and they've got something like 30 of these arcades already up and running in Europe and Russia. And it's what are they using? They're using Vive, so they're using two Vive trackers on either end, and they're tracking four people that are underneath this trestle. And so I'm assuming there's four PCs upstairs running each of these four people. They've got a cloud-based system for managing the whole arcade. So the idea being that an operator can operate and get everyone into VR started in their experience all from a mobile device. And they've also supposedly got licenses for various cartoons that are popular in Russia to turn those into VR experiences for even little kids. What I tried in there was obviously the World of Tanks VR game, as well as it was, the control scheme was far different than I expected. So they've rebuilt that game separately for every platform that they're on. So different engines, different tool sets. Mobile version is very different from the PC version, from the console version. And so this, again, was completely new. And so it's like I have my two hands, and I'm standing on the top of the tank. And I wish I could remember the more specifics of how the controls work, but I can rotate my body, and I'm actually rotating the gun of the tank. Nice. I can lock the gun. I can lock my movement to go in one direction while rotating my body to shoot in other directions. Mm-hmm. I played it for about... they also had very quick rounds. Very quick rounds. So even if I'm getting my butt kicked, I still feel like I had success because there's enough rounds to kind of at least kill one person or figure out the controls. It took a few minutes. I didn't feel simulator sick. I felt fine. And I usually get pretty simulator sick in more move games, more games that try out a little bit more.
Do you think you would have preferred to be inside of the tank, or because I know that the seating position is on top of the tank and you have like your hands, and it's kind of a not too realistic of a thing, but I saw that being a criticism
it felt
on
great.
Reddit or something.
I loved it. It took me a few minutes to get the hang of how to lock in and aim and do all those things at one time. But I'm talking like a 10-minute experience. The first 2 minutes are tutorial. So it's very quick getting you into this, and I wanted to play again. As soon as I was done, I wanted to, to beat them again or right. try to do better.
So in terms of all these like location-based entertainment, I don't know if you can speak to this, but like it seems like there's a lot of options out there, and they're deployed differently, different business models even. Are they successful? Is this something that's going to stick around? I mean, I've been hearing about them. I haven't tried any of them, and I'm just kind of curious as to like, is this working?
I need to ask the devs that the most common devs that have their apps in these arcades, whether they're seeing significant revenue. I have yet to do that. I ask that same question, and I get, nice numbers from these individual companies, but I don't know how much to trust how reliable they are. They could be changing the numbers or just giving a number that shows that they're great when they're not actually making a lot of money. But the Neurogaming folks gave me some numbers saying, I want to say they say that they're seeing a return rate of 1 in 4. Just after a few months of having this up and running, which seems like a pretty good retention rate to have those people coming back and spending more in your arcade. And then they're going to try to build things to improve that retention rate and get more people coming back. And neurogaming, that they specifically said that's the thing we're trying to solve, is the retention rate, getting people to come back multiple mm-hmm. times. And it's the thing I can't figure out whether IMAX has, or any of them really, at the Void, Dreamscape, and all of them have yet to really figure out how to make it make you want to come back multiple times. The Void doesn't have high scores, as I recall, yet. Maybe they do. Maybe they do tell you how many. But you want that photograph showing that you killed more people, more stormtroopers than your buddy. You want it to be a different experience the next time you come back. You want a slightly different story, so it's a bit like a Star Tours, and each time you come back, you see a different combo of things that can happen. Hmm. Those things aren't up and running yet with many of these arcades, and they need to establish that in order to boost the retention rates and get these people coming back again and again and again. So I'm going to say the jury is out on VR arcades right now. The number I looked for devs to understand, like, VR is not going to fail, was when individual devs of like small 1 to 3 person teams said they were making enough money to spend the next 2 years doing whatever they want to do. And in many cases, that's VR for these people that have made enough money with a small team to support themselves. And I don't think a similar threshold has been passed yet with arcades. Like, this is definitely going to take off in every city in America. I don't see that yet.
Right. Yeah, and I think it's also different per market, because I think a lot of them are trying to emulate is like the whole PC bang culture and like China and Korea, where or as far as I've heard, is like people, it's not very common for people to have like PC gaming rigs in their homes, and it's a very social event, you know, to grab your friends, go to a network PC cafe, kind of like how it was, I think, in America, or in Lebanon, we had that as well. You'd go and sit down, play Counter-Strike on LAN and have a fucking amazing time, right? And I think that's what they're trying to hit with the retention, is like, is this a cool experience that you'd want to bring your friends back and then make that into an event that you guys do together? So
multiplayer. Yeah, it's going back to what we were saying earlier about Daydream having great Chromecast integration. Like, that makes multiplayer so tempting, is when you can see something on the screen and you can do this asymmetric, something different on the screen and let people play. Playroom VR is an amazing game on PSVR. And I don't think enough people have either played it or know about it, but Playroom VR. It's a bunch of little mini games. One of them is,
it's awesome.
The person in VR is a cat, and people outside of VR are little mice. Yes.
Yeah, it's really fun.
It's so much fun. It's the most fun that my family has had in VR playing a game together, simply because it uses that two-screen gaming system. And it's, again, another form of multiplayer. You're not going to have two headsets. Like, how unlikely is it you're going to have two headsets in the same home, two people using two headsets at the same time? That's why the arcade is so tempting, is you've got four headsets ready to go. You can get four people in, have an amazing gaming experience, and then get out. And that's why they're seeing the retention rate, I think, a little bit more, because that's like, you nail that specific experience of making four people have fun together. That's going to get people coming back in different configurations, like bring new friends to see it, or bring, have parties.
Yeah. Maybe using the occasion that we spoke about World of Tanks, you know, it involves guns and shooting.
Yes.
You can do a soft, smooth all transition.
Right. No, I'll transition us there. Neurogaming has a second system. Their second system, so they've got the cinema arcade system that's similar to IMAX. Their second system is OptiTrack with Striker or Strider guns. I can't remember what they're called. Striker guns. Yeah. So they've got the Striker guns, OptiTrack, Rifts connected to OptiTrack because they've got the little face plates. Backpack PC, and they're putting you in a simulation with someone else somewhere else in the world. So I played with a guy in Russia, and he was in a similar setup. I think they're using Unreal. I'd have to ask him. But just the lighting, everything about that game, that the second system felt like a military simulation. And so we had done the World of Tanks thing. It was fun. It was like a multiplayer game. The next moment, I'm strapped in, full body. They've got trackers on my knees. It's better, the best body tracking I've ever tried. And I'm holding this gun tight to my shoulder, and I'm running. I'm basically jogging through a space. And I never had that experience before. And I have this lasting feeling of empowerment from that. Like, I feel powerful holding this gun and being able to shoot people. And I don't feel comfortable. I feel weird having had that feeling. And the moment that article came out about this system that Neurogaming's working on was the morning I read CNN's Jeremy Bailenson piece. Right. And I wish I had seen the Jeremy Bailenson piece before I had written it, because I would have linked to it and talked about it a little bit more. But I have some very mixed feelings about having experienced that kind of thing.
So can we maybe quickly do a recap of the article that you just mentioned?
Yeah, let's do that. So Jeremy Bailenson, which we've talked about before, he is a researcher at the Stanford's Virtual Reality Human Interaction Lab. And we've referenced his research a lot, actually, on this podcast, particularly with like the Proteus effect, which is all about, having an avatar really does change your behavior, in a virtual environment. And I mean, he's done a lot of research about interpersonal distances, proxemics. Anyway, so he's a pretty big name in the VR research space. Yeah, like you were saying, he came out with an article on CNN this week where his argument was that I have done research about virtual reality and training for quite some time, and the thing I've noticed is that VR is very different when it comes to, it's very effective when it comes to training. And reflecting off of that, he has a company called, what was it called?
Striver.
Striver. That they're, I believe it's like NFL companies are using to train their QBs on being more effective at their game. So Walmart, he comes out. What's that?
Walmart is using it too.
Oh, okay.
Train employees.
So expanded. So his argument is that there is, even though he says, video games, He does make the argument that like video games aren't directly linked to like making kids violent, but he says there is one documented case of a killer using a first person shooting game, Call of Duty, actually, to improve his combat skills in 2012. And so he apparently told the court that when he was captured. So he makes the argument that VR is obviously even more realistic and more of a training thing than what Call of Duty could have done in 2012. And he makes an argument that says the military has been using virtual reality to train soldiers for decades. But his main argument is that virtual reality games are going to cause people, they're not going to cause people to become violent, but if a possible mass shooter wants to hone his craft, we shouldn't hand him an over-the-counter digital boot camp. So this is, I think that's the main point that he's trying to make, right? Like, it's not that he's going to make kids kill each other or become violent all of a sudden. But if someone does want to do that and he has VR at his disposal, he could possibly use it to train himself to be more effective at it. I think on the surface level, we probably won't disagree with that point specifically. However, there's some interesting things that we called out our community on Discord, including actually one of the people that came in to talk about that is Anton from Rust LTD. We've had him on the show before. He's the lead developer on H3 VR, the Hot Dogs, Horseshoes, and Hand Grenades, which is actually, I think, one of the top selling games in VR, and it's basically the most realistic gun simulator in VR. So he also has been approached by a lot of military contractors, a lot of people that build guns, sell guns, and he's fully independent. He's also an interesting person to talk to about guns, because as much as, even though he's building a gun simulator, he's like a big staunch person on gun control, and he's like, you know, I love guns, or like, I like guns, but I don't want them in everyone's hands, which I think right now there's such a hot debate going on in America every couple of months at this point, where, you know, it's either people are like, ban all guns or don't ban all guns.
Arms
to
teachers.
We should have more guns, armed to teachers. So, I mean, we don't want to make it, we don't want this topic to be a red versus blue thing, because I mean that doesn't go anywhere, and we want to keep this kind of more research based, more science based, and talk about ideas. So I want to read his comment first, because I think Anton is probably one of the more educated people on this topic. You guys can't see it on the screen very well, so I'll read it out loud. So his argument is that I said something. Oh, actually, here, let me read this out loud. Training someone to be an armed combatant and to possibly enact a heinous act, the skill set in question is actually several completely separate ones. And he talks about, like, knowing how to, like, to work with jams and failures of a gun, the abstract tactical understanding of how to maximize attacking a soft target, the kinesthetic experience of firing a gun, the ability to aim down a real sight. You know, it's not you're not looking down a Call of Duty holographic sight or whatever in VR.
Yeah, exactly.
The exposure to operating a real gun, all these things. So he goes by point by point, and he talks about that it's not that VR can't be used for those things, but it's that you can achieve and you can train for those things better using videos from YouTube, using airsoft guns, using even paintball guns, actually.
Yes.
And VR actually is probably going to be the more expensive. And he argues that it will actually train the wrong muscles, especially when it comes to the shooting, to doing things with guns. I'm like, I'm not experienced enough to, like, you know, talk about them from a first person experience, but like, he argues that it's actually not the best thing to use to train for guns, which was fascinating to hear from someone like him, where he's trying to build a very realistic simulator. And perhaps it doesn't fully disagree with Bailenson's point, but it I think definitely is something to consider.
Yeah.
Like, and honestly, and I want to put this point out there, like, I'm surprised that Bailenson didn't, if he's writing an article about this, you would expect for him to do some kind of a pilot study, have some kind of, like, he references a few, you know, research points in his argument, but like, I feel like he should do something, you know, he should research that before he comes out and says, I mean, I don't know, what is your take?
You know, I'd need to reread the section of Experience on Demand where he talks about this specific issue. As I recall, the way he worded it in the book, at least the part that stood out to me, was saying that, yeah, so something's very similar to this article, that the military uses it for training because it works. It's very blunt and very simple in the way it's presented in the article. I think
It's more difficult.
When I talked to him, I actually called him up about his book, or no, I talked to him on the phone and then I emailed him. And it's funny, I try to be very specific in how I source the people that I talk to, because we talked about some of this stuff at the beginning. It's just important that the medium and the ways technology could change the way we talk need to be expressed as often as possible, because if I interview someone in VR, they could use an algorithm to make themselves appear that they're smiling more, they could do all sorts of things to manipulate the communication in VR. So I think it's good to get this sort of sourcing down right. But I got an email from him. I basically asked him in an email, in one part of your book, you say that field trips in VR could be great, but they're not great yet. The difficulty of building a VR field trip is just astronomically difficult to do, and no one has really done it yet. And he clarified in a follow-up email, he thinks just the curriculum needs to get better for better VR field trips. On the flip side of that, though, there's a lot of evidence, according to him, that training in VR is a home run. It's just, it makes perfect sense. And I think that the separation there between two different modes of learning, or two different ways of learning something, and he's just saying the evidence isn't there yet for one type of learning, and he's saying the evidence is there for another type of learning, is the basis of a lot of, I think, what's in this CNN article. And I have to go back to read the original research to really understand why training works. And I just don't, according to him, the field trips just aren't there curriculum-wise to make that type of learning work. But I think what we've got there is, and Anton's points being that you've got a lot of different, when you need to learn how to do something, there's many, many different aspects of learning how to do that thing. And some of the aspects can be replicated in VR. Some cannot. Some can, but only 5 to 10 years or 30 years from now. And it's a lot of these arguments are about degrees, about how quickly you can learn, how effectively you can learn, how cheaply you can learn. And I think there's a lot to mix up in that discussion. Like, just because it's not affordable now doesn't mean it's not going to be affordable in 5 years. Just because you can't get some of this training now doesn't mean you can't get it in 5 or 10 years.
Right.
And
even using different depths, right? Like your eyes looking through the scope rather than the scope. I think those can be achieved with like very focal displays. And like, I agree. Yeah. There's a lot, the technological constraints that Anton points out, I think will probably be, overcome. And even if you have like a gun, like Striker VR guns coming out that simulate recoil, I mean, I don't, in my head, I feel like that's an accurate representation, but probably not. I'm sure gun people will disagree. It's like, it's not really feeling the same. But I mean, where does this put us? I mean, I think a lot of people misread the article or misread the headlines, thinking that this is the same gun debate that we've had in terms of video games causing kids to be violent. That's not his point. That's not what he's trying to argue. There's good amount of research that says that there isn't. Although I have seen some recent stuff that says there is there's some research that says that it might make kids more aggressive, at least on a short term period.
It's not a clear topic. And when you actually look at how difficult the topic itself is, so when you just try to take it apart, one part is training. So training in VR, there's a lot of research behind it. I actually know that companies are interested in training because the company I'm working for actually tries to do training in VR. And obviously the company from him also seems to be very effective with training. But when you just pick out the topic of military, what did they use training for? It's tactics. It's, basically after you did the ground training, you crawl through the mat, you kind of shoot with your weapon. Then afterwards, you train rather the tactics, how to approach the enemy. And later, also the military uses a lot of VR for rehabilitation, like PTSD. So it's not like they necessarily train you to shoot in VR, rather train you to do tactics. And when you just take the argument, VR can make you a better shooter, right? And you say, even if it's true, as long as you don't have access to a real weapon, then there is no damage from it or no harm. So assuming that this training method in VR would work, still kind of doesn't take away the fact that people should maybe have access to guns if they could potentially kill someone. And then, we're definitely not at a technological level right now. Maybe we will be at some point. But right now, we're definitely not there where this is really a topic to discuss, because I don't see anyone, being able to train how to shoot with a Vive. Not that I'm a big shooter myself.
You don't think actually, so?
Seldomly hold a weapon. I don't think so, no. I don't think you can train to be good at, aiming, shooting, oiling up, putting it together, pistol. So when you can't feel the recoil right now, right? That's the biggest impact. You also don't really get a feeling for it. And also, only because you train something virtually doesn't mean that you will, get this frightening experience when you actually shoot your first time in real life. So when you never shoot a weapon and you just did it in VR. Yeah?
So you're right on those points, but I'll argue that the fact that like one of the bigger parts of guns is like knowing how to reload or like to arm, I don't know, just to work the weapon. And you can, I think, I've learned how to reload guns in VR and I didn't know how to LMG, a light machine gun gets reloaded, right? You have to open up the top, you have to put the chain of bullets in and put, I mean, sure, but like, I think, can't you argue that like you doing that at least 5 or 10 times in VR is, you can learn how to use that a little bit better than you can and otherwise.
And phone repairman. So whenever I have to repair a phone, actually had to repair a few phones recently, I watch a teardown video, I watch a YouTube video, and I do it myself. I wouldn't necessarily prefer watching someone or actually trying to tear apart the phone in VR, because it's like very fuzzy. You need to kind of unglue things. So certain things you need to learn with your body. It's like the embodiment. And as long as you don't feel the pressure and you don't feel, you know, how strong you need to push the bullets, maybe you might know the procedure, but who knows, maybe you will put it upside down or you will kind of push it there. Also, I think reloading a weapon, you could maybe learn from a video too. That's to your argument that, you know, you could get this information way easier. So what value do you get out of a VR shooting experience that you cannot get anywhere else and that makes you actually, you know, train? I mean, you can just take Call of Duty and see how they're, you know,
It's such a minefield what we're talking, because we don't know the effect of, you know, we don't know how effective any of these things are in VR yet. We don't know how what level it is. But I want to talk about that personal feelings I've had, and I'm assuming other people have had these feelings. But have you both played Grand Theft Auto?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Have you pulled up to a spot in real life and seen a sweet bike? And pictured yourself kicking the person off the bike and taking that sweet bike. I remember after the bikes got added to Grand Theft Auto, and I played that game for hours and days on end, and there would be a specific bike that I knew was the fastest bike in the game. And whenever that happens in game, you jump out of the car, you go up to kick the person off the bike, and you take it, and you get to go super fast the world and feel amazing. I think of that every time I think of the effects of VR long-term use. That kind of mental role-playing I did in my head, it's 10 seconds of time or 5 seconds of time. My body checks myself and says, don't go and actually do that to the person. But like, I do play it out in my head. I did play out that sort of system. And I'm assuming that other people are like that. Otherwise, you know, maybe I should get checked out by a psychiatrist. I'm assuming that if you role play these things enough in VR, you're gonna feel more comfortable to some degree in real life doing some of these things in the real world. It is my fear. I'm not saying that that's true, but it's something that I don't think we've fully gotten the research out of.
Do you think a sane person would actually, you know, be influenced by a virtual environment in a way that would do something that is not very sane? Or do you rather think that people who are not sane and who don't have the ability to check reality, how you did, okay, I don't need to kick the guy off the bike, would actually be influenced? So are we arguing here about sane people or a subset of people who are potentially not mentally sane?
It's a great question. Age deals with that question somewhat, I think.
It does. And I think Bailenson...
Age is also important, yeah.
He was kind of specifically limiting himself to talk about the people that are on the fringes of that. They have the motivation and the intention to want to to do that, you know, to kick someone off the bike. And to get to that point, they want to train themselves rather than the opposite, which is like, you do this, you know, you play it for fun, and then... will that make you want to actually kick the person off the bike and steal it? I think so. GTA is a great example, because it's such a weird, almost contradictory thing where it's a very realistic game in some senses, and it's a very unrealistic game in a lot of other senses. But it's also a very it's also a really good game. Like, it's a staple of in like the gaming industry in terms of storytelling, in terms of world building. Like, I mean, it's one of my favorite games, I'd say GTA 5. However, like, I remember hearing from someone that was making a GTA 5 VR mod, and the creator themselves was like, this is way too brutal, dude. Like, I don't even know if I want to keep playing this. Like,
there's a video when they did that mod of a person in one of the walking simulators. I can't remember which one. But their feet are walking, and that's moving them in GTA. And they walked into a corner store and just shot the store owner, and then ran out and started just shooting people on the street. And you see their little box in the corner showing what they're doing in real life, and they're holding a real gun and they're doing the walking motion in the little walking simulator. And it's just, you watch that video and realize, yeah, that's too far. Like, it's, I hate using the pornography or obscenity guideline, but like, it,
you'll know
it you look you at that it. And go, that's yeah, you'll know it when you see it. And that you know when you see it. It's a little bit too much. And that's, do you want kids doing that? Like, an adult doing that is one thing. A 15-year-old or a 10-year-old doing it is something else.
Yeah, I agree with your point, but I would make maybe a reference to history. So, for example, when Doom 1 or Doom 2 came out, I'm pretty sure it was also in other countries, but in Germany it was kind of, you only can buy it when you're 18 or you're not allowed to officially show it. Now, after, you know, how long is it, 20 years, you look at Doom 2 and you think, okay, that's just a cartoon game. I mean, no one would actually take it seriously. So they even removed it from the list of banned games. So when it came out, it was like so shocking. Oh my God, you can shoot at monsters. It's so realistic. I mean, even if you look at advertisement from, you know, 1998, 1999 about virtual reality, oh my gosh, so crazy. And also the games industry, everyone said, oh, whoa, it's so evil, you're shooting at each other. And turned out, no, it's not that evil. And obviously,
well,
you could make
that.
An argument that you, I mean, it's, but it's kind of, you never experienced
it was that
VR, and now it's crazy.
It might have been like a, it was like one big example, but since then we've had so many other games that are similar where it's saturated,
and
I feel like, and we realize that it's not causing too much harm in society, perhaps. But I think, I mean, I can't see a future where we don't have more realistic games that involve more realistic actions from us
to
kill and to do things. Like, this is, there's almost no way to stop this train moving forward. And this goes to the second point of Baileson's original article, where so he presents the problem and why he thinks it's a problem. And the solutions he then presents is about like changing the physics of how shooting works, how guns work, and how bullets work. So that, I think, is the more interesting, well, maybe not more interesting, but like we should dive into that, where he's like trying to propose certain, should we call them restrictions on like how game design should be moving forward. And he tweeted about this, where he was like, don't cling on to the physics or the bullet curve thing that he suggested. He's like, I'm not a game designer, you know, like I'm just trying to put out suggestions as to like, let's think differently in terms of the physics. And so
maybe
Anton actually,
to paintball.
So Anton is in agreement of this, where his game H3VR doesn't include humans. It's only like he has like either shooting ranges or like targets or even machines like robots that you shoot. And he's like, I don't want to create soft targets for you to shoot. So like where does, I mean, we're not game designers, but is that, I don't think trying to put restrictions on how something gets made is going to affect any of the things that he presented. Like problem here.
It's not a problem. I think if we think of VR as the ultimate empathy machine, right? I mean, you could argue that when VR develops further and there are more immersive present devices that you feel the environment, you smell it, whatever, then people naturally will go away from the idea, I want to have a perfect shooting environment in VR, to I want to have a perfect chat environment. So it might be that naturally the users will prefer content that is not necessarily war-like, because you don't want to experience war, I think. And another argument is maybe, do you still hear me?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yes, because my game froze. And another argument would be, like when you look at paintball, like paintball is very realistic to actually shooting. So how would you argue is paintball, you know, softened by any guidance to make it not combat-like? So what did people do about paintball to make it, you know, less training-like or less actually enabling you to do a real combat? And then maybe you could do the same things that you did over paintball, you know, and actually have splash. You don't have blood, I guess. I guess one important part is you should not maybe see blood coming out of a body you shoot at. Just paint. You just mark them. The bullets are colorful. So, I don't know.
Yeah.
A lot of the debate, a lot of the fight is, it seems rooted in all the failures that people see in the current regulations and way of doing things, meaning we have a rating system for video games that helps parents and families decide what's appropriate for their kids. I don't think there's a similar rating system for you know, around every VR game that's out there yet. And when you put the headset on, it's often very hard for the people, other people in the family, to know what the person in VR is experiencing. So I think there's a lot of
that,
like,
you don't have that moment of the mom walking in and seeing the kid, you know, like either watching a sex scene or like shooting, you know, whoever, but
this would be awkward.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's a lot of our rating system is great at telling people what you should do with, you know, how you should treat a video game. It's really effective. And people in the industry don't want to have a rating system imposed on them, by some kind of regulatory body. And then you've got the flip side of that, where guns, and you've got these groups of people that are just completely opposed in how we treat guns, use guns, legalize guns. And you've got the cross-border situation where the laws are completely different in every other country except for the United States. And so you get this debate that just, how do we apply the rules of the current world to the rules of VR? And it just doesn't, it's so different. Matching up and figuring out how you treat it in VR is a monstrous task. Like, I just feel bad for anyone that's trying to figure out how to provide even the simplest guidelines. Like, how you create a video game or a VR game for a kid is potentially completely different to how you make a VR game for an adult who has a solid grip of reality and wants a realistic military shooter, because that's the kind of content they want. Like, that's always the argument, is you've got the responsible people that aren't causing problems, and you've got irresponsible people, and is it going to make it more likely for them to be irresponsible is a complete unknown right now.
Right. And I think the argument goes into, like, in terms of, like, are you restricting art if you're trying to restrict the type of gunplay that you're going to have? And it goes to, again, to GTA, where, like, it is a realistic and, like, brutal game, but it is, like, a very good game. And it actually, in a sense, where, like, there's anti-war movies, right, where they include so much violence, where you realize the craziness, the inhumane aspects of war, where we shouldn't try and actively engage in. And GTA can probably be argued in that similar realm, where, like, you should probably not be enjoying the fact that you're doing these heinous things. I don't think restricting is the right thing forward, because restrictions don't work in any sense. When you have, however, even if you put laws in the U.S.
We have the search in year old restriction. I think you're only, I mean, technically you're allowed to use Oculus only when you're 13, I think, by the terms. And I think one benefit.
Guess who's playing Job Simulator? Yeah. Guess who's playing Job Simulator?
Yeah, okay. You know, like. Yeah, I mean, true. But you could also say that one of the benefits from those created ecosystems like Oculus or, you know, the walled garden is, for example, there is basically no way a young adult could access VR pornography easily. Like, it's way harder to access VR pornography than accessing normal pornography, for example.
That's so for now. That's definitely garden, a different argument.
Yeah.
That's definitely a different
argument. But it's also that you maybe should, you know, I could argue let Oculus decide what content they want to show, right? Not that I find it good, but it would be a solution, maybe.
I think they do. But, I mean, where should we draw our conclusions from this, guys? Do you think Bailenson was on? So, okay, that's one conclusion. We need more research on this topic. Was Bailenson, was he on, like, was his argument sound and valid? Do you think?
I think there's a lot we need to explore here. I still want to. I'm curious about the rating systems for movies, and the way that they, like, how many categories of things do they have in the little descriptions below the actual rating for the movie. I have two kids, and I use a website called CommonSense.com. I think it's Common Sense Media. I think it's CommonSense.com to basically determine whether my family or my kids are ready for the particular content I want to give them. So before we go out to the theater, we'll check that website and see, okay, it's dealing with this subject and this subject, and I don't really want to deal with those subjects with my kids yet. So I'm going to skip that movie. And I don't think between common sense and between the actual descriptions on the, like the rating system descriptions are violence, nudity, you know, it's six words. It's not very, it obviously avoids spoilers. The Common Sense website, I'll sometimes make my wife read it because it can go into the realm of spoilers, and I don't want to get spoiled by the movie, so I'll ask her to read it in some cases. But like, I think we need some kind of equivalent for VR. We need to know and let everyone in the everyone know this is what it's got.
I mean, that's fine, so but that doesn't,
people can make more informed decisions.
That doesn't stop people that are trying to use it to shoot, right? Like, or to train to shoot. I mean, that's good for a general mass audience, but is that stopping in any sense someone that wants to cause harm? No. And I think, I guess, this even goes into the whole realm of AI and like the how to keep our eyes open for creating something that we can't control. I mean, I think that's a very simplified argument, and I don't think even a valid one. But like, so I think my conclusion would be that don't try to put restrictions. Try to create a rating system. You're not going to stop. People that are going to want to use this technology for harm are going to. You're not going to be able to stop that.
Yeah.
And I think where the real conclusion can be drawn from is actually on the real guns. Like, and is to like not take away guns, because I think people both use it for hunting and sport, whatever. But look at other countries. Try to draw good examples from other countries, including Australia, including Japan, and VR isn't gonna, you're not gonna be able to control stop mass shootings by trying to control VR.
That's my conclusion. To take care actually of the students. You need to, you know, instead of focusing on the evil new technology that is potentially causing some harm, actually solve the problems in your society. Now make sure that there are no people who want to shoot at their students, right? At students who they go together in school, you know, figure out how to prevent the social problems that cause it.
Yeah.
This is like the biggest issue that we have as a society around the whole globe, right?
Yeah.
That's it. Oh, that's so tricky. I mean, I'm assuming you have the same disgruntled people, same disgruntled students in every country. The United States is the only one where they have very easy access to guns. So it's like, we could focus on solving society's ills, but we have kind of a special case in the United States where this type of content is available to in pair with a whole lot of guns. And so like, you could focus on making bullying and focus on a society that doesn't see guns as an option for when you've got your troubles. It's such a blunt instrument, and I don't know if there's so much about American culture and culture in the United States specifically that when you've got a problem, you solve it with a gun. That's why the American Dream game is such an interesting one to me. I don't know if you guys have seen that, but I just got a press release on it this week, which was pretty appropriate timing.
Is that the Fallout 5 game, or?
No, this is the game where it's made by an Australian, and they're poking fun at American culture, and you basically use guns for everything in your life. So, like, cooking barbecue, you use it as your tongs or whatever, and as you're a baby in the crib, you're shooting up you're shooting up your crib and stuff.
It's a VR game.
It's a VR game, and it's specifically about the American affinity for guns.
Cool.
Yeah, it's like the Simpson episode where Homer is trying to turn on the TV with a gun.
Okay, this has been a great discussion. I think one last thing I want to add is I think the fact that it's okay. So I this is beyond VR. I think the gun argument has become completely politicized between like Republicans and Democrats because, like, oh god, should we go in this realm? The NRA funds or lobbies towards specific politicians that then, maybe not in a quid pro quo sense, but like enact certain laws to then being in accordance to the NRA. And then the argument then turns into like Republicans wanting to argue for guns, and then Democrats trying to ban guns, or like at least that's the simplified version of it. And however, if people weren't in these political parties, I don't think we'd be having this debate. I don't think that people are like that strongly tied to guns. And it's actually the gun debate and the Second Amendment debate is a pretty recent one. Radiolab had a great episode where they re-released this episode that they did a few years back. I'd highly recommend to look it up. It's probably came out a week or two ago, and it's a rerun from their More Perfect series that's about laws. And it actually talks about like that the whole gun, the Second Amendment gun debate came from first the Black Panthers that were essentially the first ones that really argued that having guns as an individual is protected in your Second Amendment rights. Because up until that point, people were looking at it more like a militia sense. And then the NRA then takes that argument and also like spins it into their the Republican platform in like the 80s with Reagan. So there's a fascinating history there to be looked at. I hope we did justice to Jeremy Bailenson's article. And if he's listening to this, you know, if he has thoughts, please feel free to reach out to all of us. We'd love to have you on. If we did any kind of injustice to your arguments, please let us know. I tried to kind of break it down to like a constructive philosophical argument that we can go into. So,
because you got into the red versus blue thing, I want to put out one thing I hope happens in VR is I hope VR becomes a platform for debate that is more effective than current platforms for debate.
Unlikely.
I don't know.
I hope for that.
Yeah, right. It's like it's so far we've got awesome, you know, right? VR chat, which is like meme culture, which takes meme culture to an extreme. But the red versus blue, the way when I hear all these debates happening, the thing that frustrates me about everything that's going on is it always feels like the argument and the discussion is framed by someone else. Like you have to have your debate and your discussion in the framework that someone else has defined for you. And that's in right now, it's either the Democrats or the Republicans. Right. And it's either, you know, like you were saying, and I would hope that we can get some kind of civilized debate that helps people understand both issues more deeply. And it's unlikely, but it's definitely one of my hopes that all the social interaction that I hope comes to VR makes it possible to have really effective debates over time.
Agreed. All right, Ian, how can people find you and reach you on the internet?
My last name is Hamilton, and HMLTN, so I take out all the vowels, that's at HMLTN is my Twitter account. And you can find my links to my articles for my Twitter account, and
awesome. And you can re-find us, the Research VR Podcast, at Research VR Cast on Twitter and the Research VR Podcast on Facebook. Check us out on Discord as well. We have a pretty active community going now
where we do
kind of talk about the follow-ups to these podcasts, as well as if you have some guests that you want to suggest, we have a whole channel for that where we can talk, as well as we have like breaking news discussions in there as well. That's stuff that we can't do on the podcast. And eventually when we will start again live streaming these and hopefully hosting live podcasts with audiences, you know, sitting in the back and providing a real life laugh track, we'll probably be doing that through Discord.
Or debates.
That's a great one. We can even do a Q&A actually, which would be fascinating. Draw out a microphone and people can come up to it and speak. So something like that would be really cool. Thank you again for joining us and for listening. Thanks, Ian, for dropping in and participating in this discussion.
That was really good.
Thanks for having me.
And we'll see you guys next time.